You're listening to How India's Economy Works, hosted by journalist and author Pooja Mehra.
Hello. Today we are going to talk about manufacturing in India. That Apple makes iPhones in India sounds very cool, right? Especially when the headlines come out saying that the number of phones being exported out of India has been increasing sharply. But do know that the government gave Apple and Samsung and their contract manufacturers more than 4,400 crore rupees of taxpayer money last year, that's just 1 year, for making smartphones in India? Should India give subsidies to Apple to make iPhones here? I say this because Apple's annual sales are just about the same as India's annual GDP. Why does such a big and profitable company want money from the government to do its business here? Especially when the government can only give this money by denying funds for some other spending head, right? So when iPhones are made in India, who gains and at whose cost? Had this money been spent on something else, would the economic gains have been higher? These are important questions that can only be answered using analytical techniques that economists know how to use. Arguments such as those given by ministers, politicians, bureaucrats cannot answer these questions. Most countries get the answers to such questions before they invite large investors to set up factories, especially when those invitations are to be sweetened with special concessions. But India doesn't bother getting the answers even years after rolling out policy experiments, and then often ends up with poor results. Because our policymakers, ministers, and bureaucrats don't know how to match objectives with policies and don't like taking help from experts. They end up becoming sitting ducks for lobbying by companies. Car manufacturing is a classic case, where the government has been giving the industry sops for 3 decades, even though these companies would have set up factories in India anyway, even if the government had not given them the sweeteners. The narrative goes that Apple is moving its supply chain out of China to India. But let's look at the data to see if companies like Apple are choosing India or other countries to relocate their supply chains out of China. Vietnam's electronics exports rose from $12.1 billion in 2018 to $51.2 billion in 2023. India's, by comparison, rose to $8.9 billion from $1.3 billion. This means that 28% of the incremental non-Chinese imports to the US are now from Vietnam. Only 5.5% are from India. Other countries are performing better than India in substituting for China in the supply chain. My guest today is Suyash Ray. Suyash is a political economist. He is deputy director and fellow at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace India. He has worked at the government's think tank, the National Institute of Public Finance and Policy. He has worked at ICICI Bank, has been a consultant in the Finance Ministry and the World Bank. I don't know Suyash as well as I do some of the other guests on this series, but I follow his writings. He writes very well, which can be said for very few economists. You'll find his writings in the Wall Street Journal, the Indian Express, the IMF Working Paper Series. I asked Suyash to help us understand if India gains when Apple is given money to make iPhones in India, especially given the history of manufacturing policy here since independence. Hi, Suyash. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Pooja. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
So I want to talk to you about something that is always in the news these days, which is manufacturing smartphones. India is producing a base for Apple to produce its smartphones, also other large companies and brands. And India is doing a lot to attract these manufacturing plants to India. But the sharp question that I want to ask is that why is it that a company as large as Apple, which has annual sales, which are almost as much as India's annual GDP, why does it want, and why does a country like India, which is not a rich country, why do we have to give them subsidies for them to come and set up these manufacturing plants in India? Is this best use of India's scarce resources? We don't have a lot of money. So if we are going to have to subsidize different companies or sectors, is this the best use of our money? And is it all right for Apple to expect something like this out of India?
I think whether a particular use of money is good or not depends an empirical question. Basically, you have to ask, what are you going to get out of it, right? So I think the government's objective of giving subsidy is that it wants to make it easier for firms like Apple to come and establish their plants here and make things in India. If you look at it from the company's perspective, if you give it a subsidy for production, which goes straight to its bottom line, it adds to its profit, it makes it easier for the company to decide whether to invest in the country or not. So at that level, it's perfectly rational for Apple to accept a subsidy if it helps it decide setting up the plant in India. Because on the margins, basically investment is a decision between comparing your cost of capital and the return that you expect on the capital. So if you get a subsidy, it increases the return immediately and it helps, makes it easier for you to set up the plant. But for the country, it's a larger question that, okay, even if the plant is set up, is this the best use of money? And that, I think, is something that requires much more careful analysis of the larger benefits that flow from setting up the plant. So when you set up a plant, you start making things in India, what are the larger economic benefits that grow from there? So you can't just rely on news reports of this or that plant being set up in India because then you give a subsidy, more plants will be set up because they're getting a good kind of deal out of setting up the plant. But is that benefiting Indian economy broadly is a much harder question to answer. And so far, I think it's not clear that that is true. Because so if you look at the broader, more aggregate indicators, whether manufacturing has grown as a percentage of India's GDP or gross value added, I don't think there's evidence to show that has happened yet. Whether employment in manufacturing has grown in India, that I don't think also there is any evidence to show that is happening. So as citizens, I think we should look at the aggregate picture rather than just look at one or two companies or one or two good news stories and say, because the government policy is meant to shape the aggregate picture, right? It's a part of the larger structural transformation process that India has to go through to higher productivity, making better products, but more complex products and so on.
In fact, I saw that you have written that in the last 20 years, manufacturing GDP as a percentage of GDP has not increased. It has remained more or less stagnant despite all these policies. You have also put out data showing that even investments as captured by the national income accounts measure of gross fixed capital formation in manufacturing has not increased in the last 20 years. Employment generation also, you have shown using data, government data, that it has not really increased. FDI, there is some, because companies like Apple and their contract manufacturers are setting up here, there is some probably increase over there. And exports, exports also, manufacturing exports, we haven't really seen that kind of increase. So is it too early to be looking at, policies to show up results? Probably they will after some time.
Yeah, I think the essay that you're referring to used 5 indicators. And you're right, as I said earlier, also the share of manufacturing in gross value added hasn't increased. Mercantile export, which is the export of goods, hasn't increased. In fact, there was a slight increase over the pandemic era, but it has now come back to a lower level. FDI also hasn't increased. In fact, if you look at the data, the employment data is actually not government data. I've used CMI data on manufacturing employment, and that also shows a decline in manufacturing employment over, let's say, 5-6 years ago. So none of these aggregate indicators seem to suggest that there's been any kind of improvement as far as manufacturing in India is concerned. And I don't think it's early in one way that some of the policy interventions that have been done are fairly recent. So if you look at the PLI schemes, it's not even been 4 years, right? The first batch was done about 4 years ago, and the second batch was done about 3.5 years ago. These things take time. So I don't think we can pass judgment on these kind of interventions and policy interventions with any level of finality right now. But if you look at the broader Make in India objective, that is almost 10 years old now. So it was launched in the second half of 2014. Now we are in the first half of 2024, so almost 9.5 years it's been. So I think at that level, we can raise some kind of questions about whether the strategy is working on. And the strategy has also gone through changes. So in the last 5-6 years, we have seen rise in protectionism. We have seen more fiscal intervention like the PLI schemes. We have seen a big push on infrastructure development. So things have changed. So these specific kind of tactics we can maybe evaluate over a period of time. But the Make in India, the objective has been there almost a decade. And I think there's not much evidence to suggest that it has really worked in the aggregate.
You've written about how there have been 2 phases. One has been the ease of doing business phase and then the fiscal tools. So there's a change in strategy that we're seeing. So, if you could explain this change of strategy, and probably before you say that, why is Make in India or why is manufacturing important for an economy like India? Why are governments trying to increase manufacturing?
I think there are different reasons why government tried to promote manufacturing in India. Government has been trying to promote manufacturing for almost I mean, 60, 70 years in a variety of ways. One of the reasons is that manufacturing provides one way for people to move to a higher productivity activity from agriculture, which is somewhat more structured, and it creates an opportunity for people to join modern workforce from agriculture. It allows for that. And it's a little less difficult than, say, some of the services sectors. So there are people who believe, I mean, not just economists, anthropologists and all, who have written about the nature of manufacturing job, you know, which is like a structured place you can go and work. You can learn a little bit maybe before the job, but as an apprenticeship, you can learn a few things and you can enter into a workforce at different levels. So you may be a trained engineer or you may be just a school graduate. You can get into it and you can start working. That's on the employment side. And India, because it's got a major employment problem, it's always had a persistent underemployment problem or also occasional unemployment problem. If you create manufacturing growth in India, especially in more labor-intensive areas, it will employ many more people and create opportunities for livelihoods for many of them. That is there. But I think over time, the rationale also has changed a little bit. Like one of the things that has happened in the last 3-4 years is that China has emerged as a major manufacturing powerhouse of the world. And there's a lot more dependence on China in many supply chains. And now countries, especially India, because there is an adversarial relationship, is they want to reduce interdependence a little bit, especially in areas which are more strategic, like pharmaceuticals and all. There can be also some kind of electronic equipment where if there is a strain on the supply chain, large parts of the economy in India itself would suffer. So I'm not saying that China will necessarily weaponize the interdependence, but it can create difficulties if there is some kind of a situation with China where the supply chains are under constraint for even external reasons. I think over time, the rationale has intensified in some ways, changed in some ways, but the objective that a country like India should go from agriculture to substantial manufacturing to more services-led growth has been there for a long time. Although our growth has bucked that kind of trend, right? That pattern. We've not followed that pattern. We never really got manufacturing going in any big way. There's a significant manufacturing sector in India, but services have been much, much larger. And the typical pattern that you saw in some of the other countries that went through structural transformation, we have not seen. And India is such a large country that still, I think, politicians and civil servants and even many economists believe that we shouldn't give up on manufacturing. Although, I mean, there are interesting arguments made by economists like Raghuram Rajan, Rohit Lamba and others that we shouldn't invest too heavily on manufacturing only. We should consider our other comparative advantages in areas like services and all. And aspects of manufacturing that requires more imagination and more services type inputs, you know. So those are good arguments for sure. But in India is such a large country that you can have that as well as, you know, the other manufacturing. So we should be making clothes, like toys and machinery and all of that. So it's a fairly kind of valid and reasonable kind of objective to pursue. It's a question of whether the strategy is going to work or not.
So therefore, it makes sense for there to be a Make in India push. That brings us to the question of how to do it, you know, and how it's being done. Do you see a gap?
Yeah, so this is obviously a very big question and there are many ways to answer it. Let me just answer it in a few ways. One is that we talked briefly about PLIs earlier, which is a central government-led industrial policy approach. Now, one thing that about India that always kind of startles me is the kind of diversity we see across states. And in a country like India, something like industrial policy should ideally be pursued to the extent it can be pursued effectively at a sub-national level. Because each state has its own kind of industrial policy challenges and they are better placed to figure out what they need to do. I mean, let me give you an example where government in Delhi has understood that this is the case. Infrastructure development, right? They wanted to make a big infrastructure push 2020 onwards. And soon they realized that a lot of infrastructure development now relies substantially on states. So they've started giving every year. Since then, they've given this 50-year zero-interest loan, which is basically a grant to the states to do infrastructure development. And many states are taking it up also because they realize the central cannot really be planning all the infrastructure. It's something that states have to identify where the bottlenecks are and choose the projects, give the concessions to do all of that. Center can only enable and facilitate. I think a similar kind of approach is required even in encouraging manufacturing more explicitly through industrial policy kind of instruments. So that's one gap, I think, in the approach that we are taking right now. We need much more place-based, local, subnational approaches to doing industrial policy. But there's a lot that the union government can do otherwise to create an enabling environment for not just manufacturing, generally for investment and business in India. So there are a few areas that are directly in the union government's control. One is taxation. Direct taxes are almost entirely in union governments. There's very little direct tax that is collected at subnational level. And the enforcement of direct taxes in India requires, I think, careful attention and thought. There's a lot of direct tax disputes that are building up over the years. And those create a lot of inefficiency because many large amount of more than 10 trillion rupees is stuck in disputes. And people, some of the cases go on for several years. And many of the cases, government actually loses. Most of the cases, government loses, but the amounts are stuck there. And you think about why tax matters, because tax changes the appropriability of the profit you made. If you're going to dispute, then the predictability of whether you will keep the profit that you made goes down, and that on the margins will affect your investment decision also. Then financial market regulation is entirely with the, almost entirely, there are some small bits like check funds and cooperatives and all that at the state level. Otherwise, mostly entirely, mostly it's with the union government. There also, I think, there's a big reform agenda that there's something that happened. There was a reform in terms of central banking, market policy objectives being set. There was a reform on bankruptcy. There are on enterprise regulation. There have been some reforms on financial regulation. Payment systems have seen improvements in India. But there's a bigger agenda that kind of needs to be pursued of reforming banking, bond markets, and so on, you know. And those will eventually reduce the cost of financing. And that also, if the cost of financing goes down, then the barrier to investment also goes down. Then there is a union government can also play a role in creating more predictable kind of a working environment by having more rule of law in the way enforcement agencies act and so on and so forth. That also shapes the business environment and all of that. So a lot of enabling conditions the central government can create. And then the states can pursue a lot more of place-based local understanding of. Because one thing that is for sure is that industrial policy is very hard. That is the one lesson that comes from the experience of industrial policy from all over the world. It's one of the most capacity-intensive and knowledge-intensive policies.
For listeners with no background in economics, what do you mean when you say industrial policy? What do economists mean when they say industrial policy?
The industrial policy is any policy intervention that is meant to directly encourage moving an economy from a lower productivity activity to a higher productivity activity. So you're making something which has a lower productivity in terms of lower value of output for the kind of inputs you are using, land, labor, capital, and so on, to a higher productivity activity. So anything that directly encourages that. I use the word directly because many things indirectly will encourage that. But like you have better infrastructure, it will encourage that and all that. But industrial policy is more direct. So PLI is a very classic example of industrial policy in that sense, that it is meant to directly encourage it. And therefore, I think it requires a great amount of knowledge because it's not new. India has tried industrial policy for many, many decades. We shouldn't forget that. In fact, our approach to economic growth in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s involved into a lot of industrial policy interventions.
So, when the Make in India program was announced in 2014, the impression I got was that in at least 5 to 7 years, we will have large factories employing large number of people so that a lot of people who don't find jobs or who think they're working on farms, but they're actually, this is disguised unemployment. All of those people will find better paying jobs in these huge factories, like something like, we hear of in China. Have we seen anything like that? Have we seen this kind of a result, or was this kind of a result even intended?
I think it was intended, and it was not just intended by this government. If you remember 2014 election campaign, one of the talking points, even the ruling UPA and Congress party was making is that we will make a bigger push for manufacturing. Rahul Gandhi also gave a speech about it. It's been a goal, and it's a worthy goal. But as I said earlier also, that if you look at the aggregate picture on employment in manufacturing, there's actually been a decline in recent years. So I'm going with the CMI employment and employment data. Maybe there are other sources that will have different reading of the situation. So we have not seen really the kind of large-scale manufacturing employment that was expected. We are seeing other countries like Vietnam has seen a significant increase in manufacturing in recent years. They've been able to do that. So there are opportunities out there because quite a few companies are not just talking about it, generally trying to diversify away from China and finding opportunities. So some of them have got to Vietnam and some of them have got nearer to the large markets, like Mexico has been one of the beneficiaries and all of that. So India has also benefited to some extent, but not to any significant extent.
This takes me to what you were saying, that industrial policy is fairly complex. Are we exhibiting that kind of deep know-how in our policy making?
There are about, I think, 14 or 15 PLI schemes. So if you look at that, each one requires sectoral knowledge to understand whether we are designing it well or not. I don't have knowledge on most of the sectors. I looked at the aggregate indicators to figure out whether on the whole it's working. So each sector expert can tell you nuanced answers about whether that policy is designed well. But let me give you one or two examples that I looked at. So I studied the auto PLIs a little bit, and I've written about it also, that the auto PLI, let's leave aside the electric part for now. Let's talk about the internal combustion engine vehicles. The targets that are given for additional sales that you are supposed to achieve, production that you're supposed to achieve, and so shown in terms of sales, are actually in nominal rupee terms. So if you look at, say, 1,200 crore rupees, 5,000 crore rupees, 4,000 crore rupees, whatever it may be. And there are subsidies that are linked to meeting different levels of the target that are given. Now, if you look at the larger PLI, larger automobile companies, they will fairly, if you look at just past few years' trend, they're going to fairly easily meet the targets. And they will take most of the subsidy that is earmarked. So the question that comes is that, what is the counterfactual? Like, what wouldn't have happened if the scheme hadn't been there? So ultimately, when you're putting money on the table for anything, especially tax money, which is very expensive, right? Because there's a huge amount of economic cost of raising tax resources in a country like India. So it imposes cost on the rest of the economy. And there has to be at least 4 or 5 rupees worth of benefits, economic benefits, for every rupee of tax money you spend. You know that if you look go by Kelkar Shah kind of a calculation of this. And if you are getting production that would have anyway happened, you know, and you're giving subsidy for that, then there is a problem. So I think those are the kind of questions that each sector should have. There's also a food processing PLI on things like dairy-to-eat meals and all of those. Now, I'm not an expert in these sectors. These sector experts should look carefully and figure out whether they are well-designed. Something is to happen, which is substantially different from what would have happened otherwise, you know.
I understand the point you're making. The point you're making is that if I am manufacturing, let's say, paper or paper products, I know I'm oversimplifying, and if you're taxing me and taking away money from me and giving it to the auto sector, you're making sure that money that I could have invested in expanding my business is going to the auto sector for them to expand their business. So this raises many questions. One is that, does the auto sector even need this incentive? Would they not have expanded in any case, even without, in the absence of this incentive? So you have encouraged them by discouraging me. Net, the economy loses what I would have invested. But what it gains is nothing additional or incremental. That auto investment would have come in any case.
Auto is even more interesting because auto has had protectionism for many decades, right? So to do a PLI in auto is to basically give a cherry on the top of the cake that has already been gifted year after year after year for decades. Import tariffs are very high for automobiles across all ranges of categories. So basically, for several decades, the industry has been benefiting from very, very high tariffs. And tariffs very simply is a transfer from consumer to producers, right? Because consumers are paying higher than they would have paid for the same specification product because of the tariff. But after so many decades, you still are a very small part of the world's exports of automobiles. So if you say that protectionism is required to protect the industry while it's infant, you know, that was the whole argument, and then it grows, then you remove the barriers and then they'll compete with the world. So that test was not met. I mean, we are a small part, maybe 1.2, 1.3% of the world's automobile export after so many decades, even though it's such a large industry in India because it's protected. And then you would give PLI to the sector on top of that, you know, which is expensive tax resources. My point is not so much about this or that policy. My point was the policy-making process. I think about, did you do an analysis of ex-ante analysis of costs and benefits of something like this? Did you do a proper consultation with different people who know this area? Not just the industry, because they like protectionism. Many of them like fiscal subsidies if they can get them and so on. But there has to be much more objective analysis ex ante and also ongoing concurrent understanding of whether it's working. And then, of course, once the whole cycle is over, learning about what went wrong, what went right, and all of that. But we're not seeing much of that. It's not a very transparent kind of a system in which one can see and try to analyze and add value, give constructive criticism, not just for the sake of it, like on the margins, help improve things, you know. So what we see is the policy, but not the underlying thought process of the policy, which is where I think the interesting political choices are made. Why this? Why not that?
I don't know. In a policy system where the key decision makers, which are secretary level bureaucrats, their tenure is hardly for 2 years. And, you know, the final 2 years of their IAS career, where they're, of course, making these very important policies, but also preoccupied a bit, I feel, with, you know, what am I going to do with post-retirement? With what feathers I'm going to ruffle? Is it better for me to not take a decision? Is it better for me to take a decision? In any case, they are not accountable and answerable 2 years later. So I'm not sure, like you have written, you know, our system is conducive for very good policy choices as long as bureaucrats are making those choices.
I think ultimately bureaucrats have to make the choices in terms of analyzing different alternatives, proposing the right alternative. The ministers have to approve. Most of these schemes actually go to cabinet for approval. You know? Then there's an appropriation in the parliament. There's a whole system of accountability that is there for the bureaucrats, right?
Did they even tackle the question that you've written about, for instance, that when you're giving a PLI for smartphones, they're essentially taking resources from consumers and giving them to producers?
Yeah, so I mean, PLI is on the margins funded by tax money. And tax money, as you know, in India is basically raised primarily through GST and the direct taxes and a little bit from excise. Most of it coming from individuals, you know, and from their pockets. And when you do protectionism, as you raise tariffs, import tariffs, basically, on the margins, the consumers have to pay more for the same product. Pay more means the producers of those products actually will get that additional kind of revenue because they're not competing with the producers in other countries. So it's a protected kind of environment. So foreign firms will also come and invest and make here because where importing is very, very expensive. So it makes more sense to invest in India, but all of it is ultimately financed by the consumers in the country. So ultimately, everything consumers to pay for. Government is a pass-through, corporations are a pass-through, all of that.
I think the thinking behind some of the PLIs was that, you know, they thought that if they could encourage building on scale, production on scale, that would become a comparative advantage for India. For some of the others, they thought, you know, they may not be comparative scale, but it would lead to a strategic necessity getting addressed for which they didn't want to depend on imports. And third, I think purely wanted to reduce import because the current account deficit was just otherwise going to become too much to handle.
Yeah, as I said earlier, for the strategic kind of product categories, the rationale has changed because of the same dependence on China. So if you look at the first three PLI schemes that were announced, they were on starting materials, APIs or pharmaceuticals, large-scale electronics and medical devices. And there was some thinking, I think, in designing those. And that's why I think those have to be seen separately. And then within 6 months, as it happens in government, something looks interesting, then everybody wants to replicate it. Then we went to some, 11 more categories, you know. And some of those were, I think, rushed because, you know, policy design takes time. You can't just do something in 1 or 2 months. It requires a little bit of more. And that's why I suspect that some of these PLIs that were added and now we are seeing the second generation of those PLIs, if we had more information, we would figure out what thinking has gone into it. I'm sure there is some thinking because of the file, they would have given an argument, you know, that's the way the government works, this is going to work. But that has not been subjected to any public kind of criticism. So we don't know the robustness in that thinking. But I do agree that some of the strategic product categories, especially pharmaceuticals and medical devices, some of the electronics product categories, we should carefully do a little bit of industrial policy to reduce dependence on just one country so much. And I think that's a fairly reasonable objective to pursue. But then to do it in so many food processing industries and industrial combustion engine vehicles and all of those, I think each one has to stand for itself.
This reminds me of the mindset post-independence where we just didn't want to depend on the rest of the world and we wanted big PSUs we wanted. So tell us about, you know, industrial policy in the early years of independence.
If you look at the years after independence, the private investment was very small in India. We had 50 years of almost economic stagnation. So whatever you say, in the 50s, it is clear that growth rate accelerated to some extent. And substantially, there was some problem of what you call missing markets, right? Like, it is not clear to what extent the markets would have come and just providing private investors, regulatory kind of certainty, infrastructure, and all of those. And the direction that was taken is that government has to lead in terms of investments in the economy. And the idea was to invest a lot in capital-intensive sectors. I think now many people critique that idea, but at that time, there were serious economists who were arguing for that kind of an approach. It's like a big effort by government, which solved many, I mean, potentially could solve many of the coordination problems that come in emergence of markets and market-led investment. And then once these activities take off, then the assumption was that private investment would also grow and other kind of activities will happen on their own. And to some extent, we did see acceleration in growth in the 50s and 60s. But this approach, I think, went too far. And it was also, I mean, accompanied with a great deal of control on private economic activity. So if you look at the bottom line of that period, in my mind, the key is this, that a lot of learning happened. A lot of technological know-how got built. Quite a bit of investment increase did happen. If you look at it, was, I think, the vast capital formation in the early 50s was less than 10% of GDP or something. And it doubled over the next couple of decades or so. All of that happened, but because of the control that government had over private economic activity, we couldn't really pluck the fruits of this effort that government had made in the 50s and 60s and the kind of learning that was happening in India to try to meet the limited demand of the domestic economy, because we were kind of an inward-looking kind of economy, a closed economy. So there were people who were trying to build more, to learn to make scooters or this and that and try to sell in the market. But even there were so many restrictions because of the license permit, Kota Raj. So it was a very bad combination that you had created this kind of a closed economy in which at least a little bit of response was given by domestic capitalists to do more learning. But then when they started to make more, you restricted them in a variety of ways. So, and that was, of course, a policy, but also a state capacity issue, that your state didn't have the capacity to really implement anything like license permit, Kota Raj, with even modest level of competence, you know. And by design, policies like these are bad. But even if you had these policies in a high capacity, maybe you would do a little better. So you had a lot of capacity constraints and you ended up basically stifling the economy in a very big way. And when you opened up, basically, if you look at the opening period, it was the same old technological know-how, learning. A lot of the industries were not able to compete, but many old companies were able to compete because they had know-how. They were able to compete in the new economy because they were freed up in many ways, right? I remember hearing some of the industrialists who said that, you know, in the previous time, we knew how to make more, but we're not allowed to. Now we are allowed to and we are able to benefit from that. And new companies came up and so on. One key part of that was the dominance of the public sector. So in many sectors, it was government-owned enterprises that were seen as the champions, national champions, who will lead the charge in terms of investment and building technological know-how and serving the demands of Indian economy. And when you have a large public sector enterprise in any sector, it's very difficult to create competitive neutrality, treating private sector also at par with them. So it became very difficult in many areas. In fact, private sector was not allowed at all, or was allowed but restricted, heavily regulated.
What was the objective of restricting the private sector? Or what was the objective of having a license permit? What were they thinking? What were they trying to do?
The ideology kept changing over time. But one of the things that kind of really strikes me, the ideology that large private capital shouldn't really be there in India. It should be small ones. Private enterprises should be small and medium. And many, many product categories were restricted to be made only by SMEs. You know, it is the opposite of this economy of scale thinking, you know, building advantages that you could compete with the world and all of that. So if you look at the list of products for which only SMEs were allowed to be in the private sector, government could do whatever it wanted. So it was a very long list, you know. So the thinking was, I think it was ideology mainly, that large capital is not something which we want really to flourish too much in India. There were some who were able to grow, but it must have been very hard. I don't know how they survived. But otherwise, there's a strong ideological push that government will do the heavy capital investment and the private production investment should be limited to SMEs. Even at that time, many economists would argue against this kind of a strategy, right? You said, no, and they were arguing, literally, there were many economists who were arguing that this is not our approach. But they had a strong kind of ideological conviction that SMEs are the ones that should be encouraged. Even now, we have a little bit of that, but I think we have mostly shed that baggage.
So I think one of the learnings is that SMEs can't do the kind of manufacturing that the country needs. And am I right on that note?
Depending on the kind of products, for some of the products, SMEs may be more cooperative, they may be better. But for other products, you know, I'm not thinking from a central planning hat here. So like for some of the products, like artisanal products and all, maybe a small scale has certain advantages. In food industry, maybe there are some segments where keeping things small, you can have better quality control, you can supply better, all of that. So some people never have the knowledge to decide which category should be made only by SMEs and which should be made by large. And this was a choice that was making year after year for many decades. So there was quite a bit of this assumption that I know everything, you know, that guided policymaking at that time. And I fear that some of it is coming back.
The government knows all, is it?
Yeah, some of it, like that we can really know who are the companies that are better, which product categories are worth backing, you know. Not just at local level with a little bit more specific knowledge about that area. So, I mean, we're not as bad. I mean, it was pretty bad earlier. So, I think we are very, very far from that. But we should certainly guard against the possibility of going back to that. An assumption that government knows better than consumers.
Right. On that note, Suresh, let me thank you for this conversation about India's manufacturing and with special focus on the current thrust on PLIs.
Thank you, Pooja, for having me. This was fun.
Days after this conversation was recorded with Suresh, Rajiv Chandrasekhar, the minister in charge for electronics and IT, tweeted that the Apple ecosystem gave employment to more than 1.5 lakh people under the PLI scheme in the year 2021. Sounds very impressive, as the minister must have intended it to be. But we must ask the right questions. The first thing that the government should ask Apple to explain is what definition of jobs they have used when reporting this figure. What are these people employed doing? How much are they being paid? Do these jobs qualify as formal jobs as defined globally? Are the pay scale and benefits on par with global standards? Would Apple not have made iPhones in India in the absence of the subsidies?
You've been listening to How India's Economy Works, hosted by journalist and author Pooja Mehra. Do stay connected with more of our coverage at The Core. You can check out our website or sign up to our newsletter at www.thecore.in. That is www.thecore.in. Do also track us on LinkedIn, where we usually post synopses or extracts of our top stories and interviews. We would love your feedback, so do write to us at feedback@thecore.in. Thank you for listening.